Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 339. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. What a show we have for you this week. We must get started with our guest. Heather Kronk is the co-director of Get Equal, an organization that has as its mission to empower the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community and our allies to take bold action. I love the phrase, bold action, to demand full legal and social equality and to hold accountable those who stand in the way. Prior to her work with Get Equal, Heather was the chief operating officer at the New Organizing Institute, overseeing operations and expanding programs. She's also worked with organizations such as My Society and Idealist.org, always focusing on building community and pushing for tangible social change. And now she is here with us to show us how it's done. Heather, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thanks so much, Ken.
We have so much ground to cover, Heather. Are you ready?
I can't wait.
Okay. Let's do a little Heather, This Is Your Life. I'm seeing a background in Kentucky. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I moved around a good bit while I was growing up, but most of my childhood was spent in Kentucky, and my parents still live there now.
I know nothing about Kentucky. I think they recently joined the Union. I don't know much.
I get that a lot when I tell people that. It's actually a beautiful, beautiful state, a state that's really struggling a lot, but really a fantastic place to call home.
Wow. I know that's good bourbon. It's not that far from Cleveland where I am.
It's not, and in fact, I was just at home for the holidays and managed to bring a couple of bottles of small batch bourbon back with me to my home in Maryland. So I always manage to pick up a little bit of bourbon when I go home.
Heather, I think we should be closer. Just saying.
Happy to do that.
I'm just saying. I am also seeing, which I love seeing, a master's in divinity. That's a different path.
It's true. That is a long story, probably involving bourbon. but yeah, I actually, when I was in college, I majored in religion and philosophy and went to seminary right after college. And it was actually in seminary where I kind of was introduced to kind of a whole world of social justice work, and I'm extraordinarily grateful for my friends and classmates there for really expanding my worldview a lot.
Oh, that's so great. I would imagine that background, as you said, really does inform how you approach some of this work.
It does, absolutely. I mean, in seminary, that's where I came out. That's where I really sharpened my view on social justice and my view on the world. And it was incredible to kind of sit every day with folks who, most of whom had not come straight out of college.
Yeah.
Most of whom had had, you know, one or two or three careers, many of whom had worked in churches or worked in hospitals, where they really had to wrestle with folks with tough questions, sitting with people on their deathbed and sitting with people in some of their darkest days. And, it's, you know, a lot of those same skills and same experiences happen when you're out doing community organizing as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we're going to talk about Get Equal, but I have a couple pieces from your past that I would love to talk about. That sounded way more salacious than I meant it to. It's a little bit. It's not like that. It's not like that, folks. First, I have to tell you, I love Idealist. It's one of my favorite websites mm-hmm. out there. How did you come to be involved with them?
Yeah, so after I graduated from seminary, I did a year of AmeriCorps Vista up at a college campus in Vermont, and it was there where I really, I'd actually originally gone into seminary to do counseling, quickly decided I know nothing about the world, I definitely shouldn't be telling people what to do with their lives, and so, you know, sort of had this blank slate when I graduated, had no idea what to do with my life, started working at a college campus and really kind of had the opportunity to do a lot of counseling with students who were, you know, kind of trying to navigate their own, you know, view on the world and what to do with their lives as well. And I went to work with Idealist after I did that year of service, working with a campus program of Idealist. So really working with college students all across the country, not only helping them to figure out, you know, Idealist is really has been and was primarily geared around nonprofit jobs, yeah. nonprofit careers. So there was certainly a lot of that. But also, you know, helping people figure out just broadly how to make an impact on the world. So whether that was a nonprofit career or whether that was figuring out, you know, how to stand up for divestment on their campus or, you know, any number of other things. It was a real pleasure to be able to work there for about 2.5 years.
Oh, I bet. I would say that professionally, as a college professor, it's one of my favorite resources to give my students when they're kind of looking for that purpose. But then personally, I got to tell you, at various points in my life when I'm thinking, what is it I'm really doing? Idealist is one of my first stops to figure out what is it I'm really doing. So it's good stuff.
It's a nice place to kind of go window shopping for a career a little bit.
I'm sure I have no idea what you're talking about, except that I do it like every Tuesday. So there you go. One other piece. I loved learning about the Youth Popular Culture Institute.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually got connected with them through a woman who I was playing tennis with. We knew each other, you know, through a tennis team, and kind of got to know each other, became friends, and she asked me to get more involved with their work. So it's a nice way to also kind of keep in touch with specifically youth-oriented organizing and you know use of popular culture in social change. So it's been a real privilege to be able to work with them as well.
So great. Everybody should check them out. We certainly have to do a shout-out to your tennis skills. What should we be wary of on the court coming at us from Heather?
Well, I messed up my shoulder a while back, or I would say my serve.
Okay.
But I am trying to recover from a messed up shoulder, so my serve is pretty weak right now, but I can dish out a pretty good drop shot.
All right. I think that we are the mixed doubles team to be reckoned with.
Well, we'll do that, and then we'll have a little bourbon afterwards.
I think we should do it before as well, but that's great. That's great. Good stuff. All right. We have to talk about Get Equal. So many different facets. First, give us the spiel on when someone says, well, what is this organization? How is it different from all the other LGBT organizations out there? What is Heather's answer to that?
Yeah, so Get Equal was really started primarily for two reasons. One, because when we first launched in 2010, there really wasn't a national grassroots organizing arm within the LGBTQ movement. There were some organizations that had elements of grassroots work, mm-hmm. but were really kind of oriented more toward ballot initiatives or local campaigning around, you know, specific electoral issues, not, you know, true grassroots organizing in how the sense that I think about it, building groups, developing leaders, organizing around local issues that are derived from the community. So that was kind of, you know, one piece of why we launched. But the other reason that we launched and the other tactic that we use a lot is that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, the LGBTQ movement was arguably the best use of direct action.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, especially during the AIDS crisis, our community was really out of necessity, had to be bold, had to be in your face, had to be creative, had to use direct action. And as the movement, as the community kind of became more professionalized, became more centralized in D.C., the movement moved away from that. And what we're seeing now, what we saw in 2010 and what we're seeing now is that crisis hasn't let up. And in order to move the people who we need to move to make real change in this country, we've got to confront those systems head on. So, you know, we use a mix of grassroots organizing and leadership development and training and direct action in order to move forward our agenda of LGBTQ liberation.
So how do we go about assessing if Get Equal is doing well? How do we figure out, all right, so we have this organization we're seeing. We certainly saw Empire Pride Agenda shut its doors, which mystified mm-hmm. a lot of people in the community because there's still so much work to do there in New York. How do we figure out, all right, we're sitting down, how is Get Equal doing?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we hold as a marker of our success is whether we're able to move the movement to the left. So when we launched in 2010, the LGBTQ movement was sitting in a fairly moderate position. Right? We were working on hate crimes. We were working on marriage. But there wasn't really kind of a strong, articulate left flank of the movement. There was in local pockets. So, you know, there are groups like the Audre Lorde Project and Breakout and, you know, other more localized groups that have been doing that work well for a really long time. But that wasn't kind of breaking through to the national movement. And so what we've seen is since we've come into the movement, since we launched, we've been able to kind of pull the movement toward not just talking about immigration, which in 2010, the LGBTQ movement was not talking about immigration, but talking about it in a really robust and nuanced way, right? Talking about detention conditions, talking about why the federal government is in the business of detaining and deporting people, talking about the prison-industrial complex, talking about racial justice and economic justice. And so one of the ways in which, you know, we think of whether or not we're successful is what the, you know, kind of national agenda for the movement is. And I think, you know, over the past, you know, nearly 6 years since we've launched, I think it's inescapable to say that the movement has surged to the left. And that's work that I'm really proud of.
That's so great. Is there any part that I'm just going to speak from the eye and then you, Heather, get to say, no, we don't experience that at all. I certainly struggle a little bit, and openly, we've had so many of the leaders of national organizations on the show. And I think that one of the criticisms, in addition to the amazing work that they're doing, but one of the criticisms is that it doesn't feel very grassroots. It doesn't feel like they're doing direct access to LGBT equality, and yet what we see time and time again is that a lot of the resources are funneled towards those national organizations, which for me perhaps can get a little bit frustrating when I'm doing some of the more grassroots direct action work. How do you all approach working with the national organizations?
What I always say is, you know, my goal isn't for, you know, organizations like HRC or others to go away. My goal is for them to be better.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the ways that you call organizations or push organizations to be better is by showing that you're effective, showing that an agenda is effective, showing that tactics are effective, showing that strategy is effective. And I think that, you know, one of the things that has been really interesting to watch in the marriage equality movement is, you know, the narrative of marriage equality over the past couple of years. First of all, the narrative in the national press is, wow, we've never seen a movement work so quickly. We've never seen a movement succeed so quickly. And that I think, plays into and feeds this idea that if you talk to mayors of towns, if you talk to electeds, if you talk to the grass tops and not the grassroots, then you win, right?
Yeah.
But what happened before the you know, past, you know, 5 to 10 years of marriage equality work was 20 years of work from organizations like Marriage Equality USA that had been, you know, kind of priming the grassroots, that had been creating the space for people to tell their stories, that had been, you know, kind of showing what LGBTQ lives looked like and convincing people that it was okay to come out. And so you can't have a grass top if you don't also have a grassroots.
Right.
And part of what I think Get Equal's role is in the movement is making sure that we're kind of holding the line on that and saying, yes, you know, there are things to be changed in D.C. There are policies to be changed. There are laws that need to be passed. Absolutely, of course. Also, the laws don't actually have any bearing whatsoever if you're not teaching people to tell their own story, teaching people to confront fear. You know, passing a law isn't actually going to make people less afraid. So you have to actually do that kind of the grinding, really, you know, on the ground grassroots work of engaging people where they are. That's what we saw in the marriage equality movement, but I think that, you know, a lot of the national media has only told the very tip of the iceberg of that story and left a lot of the heroes of that movement out. And I think that, you know, Get Equal plays a similar role across issues, that we strongly believe, I strongly believe, that in order to make change, yes, there needs to be, you know, some work that's happening at the grass tops, but most of that work has to happen at the grassroots.
Absolutely. Listeners, again, we're here with Heather Kronk, the co-director of Get Equal. What does it mean to be a co-director? We don't often see that word co in our bios.
Yeah, you know, I was telling someone the other day who's the ED of an LGBTQ organization, I don't know how anyone serves as a sole executive director. This work is so hard. It makes you question so much. It's so exhausting that I am just so deeply grateful, not only for my current fellow co-director, Angela Peoples, but my fellow co-director before Angela, Felipe Sosa Rodriguez, and other folks who have led this organization. And I'm also grateful to our board for, you know, recognizing that that was a move that we needed to make, that if we're going to reimagine the movement, we have to reimagine what leadership looks like. Not a day goes by that I'm not grateful for that structure and the ability to have, you know, a really trusted partner in this work and a confidant and someone who I can run ideas past. It's really pretty extraordinary.
That's a doubles team. That's a doubles team right there.
That's right.
In your vision, in your mission statement online, one of the bullets that I want to call out again, if I feel like I'm being salacious, and it's not the way I go, but this was just so beautifully worded, and I want to know how it plays out. In there, one of your goals is to refusing to count as friends those who stand in the way of equality, regardless of party affiliation or individual or organizational agendas. That strikes me as being critical in this work.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that has yielded a lot of controversy around our organization and our work. I've been accused of being, you know, Get Equal being funded by Republicans because we're so hard on Democrats. And, you know, the truth is that I don't know why you build political capital with politicians if you don't ever use it, right? So, like, they're the kind of overarching stance in D.C. with groups that are based in D.C. and kind of the culture of politics in D.C. is to align yourself with whoever has power. Well, that doesn't make any sense. The agenda of liberation is not tied to a political party. So, you know, when we launched in 2010 and we were calling out Democrats for not doing more on Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, people were aghast inside the movement. Movement leaders were aghast. How dare you say that Democrats aren't doing enough? And so, you know, in addition to other pieces of our work and other perspectives on our work, you asked earlier about one of our markers, you know, our markers of success. One of them is also, are we retaining our role in the movement as truth tellers?
Right.
And the minute that we cease to be truth tellers, I don't think we're doing our job.
Yeah.
And you know, for me, just, you know, my own liberation and the liberation of you, Ken, the liberation of other people who may be listening, it's way more important to me than political party. So I get that, you know, there are moves that people have to make and there's positioning and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're responsible for our own liberation. If we're not demanding more from political leaders, then we really need to rethink that.
So great. You gave a shout out to this earlier, and it's certainly one of our commitments on the show to talk about racial justice at any possible opportunity. Talk to me about that intersection between Get Equal and racial justice and representation and really moving the needle forward.
Mm. Yeah, I was just in Cleveland in November. We were doing some organizing around the one-year anniversary of Tamir Rice's murder.
Right.
And for those who may not know, Tamir was a 12-year-old boy, lived in Cleveland, was out playing on the playground near his house, and different versions of the story diverge at this point, but it appears that he had a fake gun, a pellet gun, play gun. Someone called in the police saying, you know, look, I don't think this is a big deal. He's a kid, you know, but just want to make sure that there's nothing wrong. Police come up on the scene. Within 2 seconds, they shoot and kill him. They then, as Tamir is dying, they then detain his sister who came out of the community center next door to see what was going on. And, you know, the scene plays out from there. The police officers who were responsible for that murder were then not indicted by the grand jury.
Indeed.
As is predictable, as plays out in communities across the country. And one of the reasons why it was really important for us to be there, one of the reasons was that we were asked to be there by the Rice family. We were asked to kind of help organize not only a response of accountability with the police department, but also a celebration of Tamir's life. And I think one of the reasons why that's so important for an LGBTQ organization to have a presence in a situation like that, that actually Tamir wasn't old enough to even know who he was.
Right.
Right. Doesn't matter. Like, you know, we got a lot of criticism around that, a little bit of criticism around that, by saying, well, this isn't a gay issue. And my response was, who knows? Who knows whether that is? And who's to say what is a gay issue and what's not? What's an LGBTQ issue and what's not? The fact is there was an injustice done. Police violence, you know, disproportionately impacts LGBTQ folks and other minority vulnerable populations. And so it's important to show up, and it's important to keep showing up. So we've done a lot of work over the last couple of years. That's been a learning curve for us and for our network. It's been a learning curve for the movement. The movement is still not there, but we've got to show up and keep showing up on issues of police violence, on issues of voting rights, on issues, you know, like in Flint, Michigan, with lead being put into the water in order to save a couple of bucks. I mean, these are all issues that impact LGBTQ folks. Whether our movement has described those issues as LGBTQ issues in the past or not.
And that's how we build allies, is by working on all these different issues.
Well, it's how we build allies. I mean, if you want to sort of look at it in a politically craven way, it's how you build allies, because if you show up for people, then people will show up for you, right? It's also just being human.
Yeah.
It's also just like being a decent human being who's showing up to say, actually, I want to say clearly and unequivocally, police should not be shooting 12-year-old boys.
There it is.
Right? Like,
yeah.
It does not matter whether Tamir was gay or trans or straight or whatever. Police shouldn't be killing 12-year-old boys.
Right.
And so for us, it's important to say that and continue to say that. And the fact is, you know, a lot of the organizing that's happening right now across the country to combat police violence is being led by and envisioned by queer folks of color. And the fact that's happening, that queer folks of color are stepping into that moment, means that the movement actually needs to reach to that rather than justifying it.
Yeah. Heather, what do you get personally out of doing this work?
Well, that's a good question. I actually don't know if anyone's ever asked me that before. I mean, I think for me, I feel like because of my life experience, because I, you know, grew up in a southern state, I grew up in an evangelical, conservative church setting, went to seminary, had a crisis of conscience, and was able to gain some skills through a couple of, you know, interesting and fortunate job situations. I feel like I have some skills that I can lend to the movement. I don't want to be in the movement forever. I'm not, you know, building a retirement plan in the movement.
Right.
I don't think that people should. I have been really clear that not only as an organization should we, you know, get equal and go home. You know, I don't want the organization to be around forever. I also don't want to be in leadership of the organization forever. So I think, you know, one of the things that I'm really excited by and that I get out of this work is that grassroots organizing, when done right, means that you're developing extraordinary leaders. And so I can't wait for the day that, you know, we have such a rich and such a diverse and such a powerful grassroots network that there are, you know, 1,000 other people leading this movement rather than me and rather than the folks who are in leadership now.
So much of what you guys do is leadership development. You have our listening audience out there. How do we start, folks? What's step one on that path to cultivating new leadership?
You know, the thing that has been the most interesting thing for me to watch is there are two things. One is political education and political analysis, and the second is communities of care. So, for example, I was just in North Carolina a few months ago. We had a convening of some of the folks who have been organizing with us for a while and then a bunch of new folks. And watching folks who were new to that network sort of turn the lights on for themselves. They didn't have the lights turned on. They turned the lights on for themselves on kind of putting a bunch of different pieces of political analysis together was extraordinary. And for example, there's a black trans woman who lives in a rural area of North Carolina. We were asking the question of, you know, what are the places in your area? What are the places of pain in your area, right? Like, where are the places, literally name the places, name the physical locations that cause pain in your community. And she said, well, you know, I had never thought about it before, but there's a restaurant down the street from me that has a whites only sign on it. And I just, you know, had ignored it. I just never go by there. I, you know, don't drive down that street. I don't go in that place. But it just never occurred to me that that's something that was messed up and that I should try to fight. And the fact that she was sort of putting all those pieces together in the room while we were all sitting there was extraordinary. And that sort of, unleashed her political imagination and figuring out, well, what are the systems that keep that in place? Right, like who are the people on city council who haven't said a word about that?
Right.
Who, you know, what are all the pieces that I can start to kind of unlock to figure out what about my community and what in my community is enabling that sign to be left up, and what can I do about that? But then the second really important piece, and our network is just now figuring out how important this is and how we can be more intentional about it, is also creating communities of care around folks. Because if she has to, you know, as a black woman, as a black trans woman, try to take on those systems herself, that is going to be so exhausting so fast.
Yeah.
So it's really important to us to then kind of, you know, figure out, well, what support do you need? What support do you need from a national network where people can, you know, text you and Facebook you and say, look, I have your back. But also, what are the places, how can we help you build a group in your local community who can then fight that fight with you?
Yeah.
And so I think for us, you know, we do a lot of training on organizing skills and community building and, you know, how to tell your story and that kind of stuff. But equally important is political education and making sure that folks have your back when you need them.
Nice. What keeps you motivated through those frustrating times? How do you keep yourself going in doing this work that can sometimes be exhausting?
Literally sitting in the room with folks like that and
yeah.
Watching the lights go on. I think especially the piece of the journey where folks start to learn strategy is the place that I get really excited.
Nice.
You know, when folks start to deepen their political analysis, that's awesome. When they start to, you know, learn how to tell their story for the first time and invite people into that, that's awesome. But really when they sit down and start to think in a more strategic way, that's where I sort of, you know, see the impact, see our network's impact exponentially grow. You know, when someone goes from, well, maybe I should have a conversation with the people at that restaurant, and moves to, well, how, you know, who are the people on city council who have also ignored that that sign for a really long time? How do we start to bring them into this conversation? How do we start to set up meetings there? Who are the pastors in the town who can help stand with us and say this isn't right? That's where I get a lot of energy.
I love it. My favorite question to end with that I ask all folks who hold a role such as yours, I give you the stage right now to sing the praises of your staff, your board, your volunteers.
Mm. God, well, how much longer do we have on the show? Because I could do that for a really long time. We have a small staff, a comparatively small staff. For a grassroots organization, it's actually, I think, pretty significant. But compared to organizations, it's a small staff. And they're truly, truly extraordinary. So my fellow co-director, Angela Peoples, is just literally one of the best people who I know in my life and who I count as a dear friend. And with whom I would not be able, without whom I would not be able to do the work day in and day out. Our other staff, L. Hearns, Wooten Goff, Yersei Arredondo, and H. Cap Clote, are just tireless, really extraordinary and tireless in the work that they do each day. All of them are working out in the field and you know, working to support folks in their communities each day, and it's grinding work, and it's also exciting work, and I'm really grateful to be able to work with them. And then our board is also, you know, we talk with our board once a month, and they're just really, really instrumental in helping, especially helping Angela and I kind of remain grounded and keep, you know, keep a vision on the horizon, and really amazing to be able to, you know, support us and ask good questions, and I'm really grateful to them as well. And then our grassroots network is, again, some of the most powerful people I know who are fighting fights that I can't even imagine, and who have been so generous and gracious to invite us into their lives, and who are just, a lot of them facing extraordinary odds, and they have really built power in ways that are amazing to me, inspiring to me. And I hope that listeners of the show will join that network, because it really is some of the best people I know.
Well, the first step to joining that network is to be informed, folks. So we need all of you listeners to stroll on over to getequal.org. You can read all about their mission, their values, their vision, the town halls, the press, everything that's going on over there. I have to tell you, Heather, I'm so inspired by not just the work that you guys are doing, but just your approach, this way of building coalitions and getting voices out there and amplifying those who are trying to create actual change. It's just inspiring, and I thank you guys, and you have to convey this to all of your staff and your volunteers and your board. You guys are doing just incredible work out there.
I will do that. I really, really appreciate that, Ken, and appreciate the chance to talk with you and talk with your listeners, and I'm really excited about what's ahead.
All right. We got to watch out for her drop shot, but in the meantime, getequal.org. Heather, thank you so much for doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Ken.
I want to tell you a story about the house rent blues. I come home on Friday, had to tell the landlady I done lost my job. She said, "That don't come for me, long as I get my money next Friday." Now next Friday come, I didn't get the rent, and out the door I went. One bourbon, one scotch, and one beer. Well, I ain't seen my baby since I don't know when I've been drinking.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, tons of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBT news out there. A lot of drama this week with an endorsement, of all things. That should be such a happy thing. But the Human Rights Campaign came out this week, and they endorsed Hillary Clinton. And people are not so happy about it. Some people are very happy about it. Other people, not so happy about it. For me, I don't get it. It just seems so unnecessary at this point to come out and endorse Hillary Clinton. So if you were to stroll on over, and I encourage you to do it, let's do our research together. If you were to stroll on over to hrc.org, the Human Rights Campaign's website, you would find a big old face of Hillary Clinton staring at you and a big old announcement that the HRC is endorsing Hillary Clinton. And if you click on Hillary Clinton, you will see all of her LGBT accomplishments. And the way that it is all phrased by the Human Rights Campaign is that if a Republican were to be elected, there are any number of LGBT rights that would be turned back, that would be eliminated altogether. And so we have to elect Hillary Clinton. And then the website goes on to list all of Hillary Clinton's LGBT-related accomplishments. The difficulty is the Human Rights Campaign makes it seem like Hillary Clinton is A, the only Democratic candidate, which she's not, and B, the only Democratic candidate with a pro-LGBT record, which, you know, she's not. There's this guy named Bernie Sanders. Now, let me pause right here and say, I am not telling you who to vote for. I am not telling you who I am voting for. I'm not even telling you what party you should be affiliated with or what party I'm affiliated with. But as a side note, I'm a Democrat, so there's that. Just spill the beans right there. So this isn't about pro-Bernie Sanders. This certainly is not anti-Hillary Clinton. This is actually questioning why it was so necessary for the Human Rights Campaign at this time to come out and support Hillary Clinton before a single primary, before a single caucus. And further, to not only endorse Hillary Clinton, but to not mention Bernie Sanders and make it seem like the endorsement is based on LGBT record. It's disingenuous. The endorsement is unquestionably about viability. The Human Rights Campaign thinks Hillary Clinton is the most viable candidate, and like any number of lobbying firms out there, lobbying organizations, I shouldn't call them a firm, lobbying organizations in Washington, D.C., they want to throw their support behind the candidate who's most likely to get elected. That's Hillary Clinton by any number of polls. So this is the Human Rights Campaign doing their ally building in that politically craven way, which Heather Kronk did such a great job of shouting out earlier in our show. This is the Human Rights Campaign getting in good with the candidate who is most likely to be elected, which is Hillary Clinton. But it's disingenuous for them to put out there that it's based on LGBT record. It's not. If it were based on LGBT record, you can actually make the case, I'm not doing it, but some would make the case that Bernie Sanders has a stronger LGBT record than Hillary Clinton. There was an article that was released this week that questions that Bernie Sanders maybe wasn't always a marriage equality advocate, but nobody is disputing that he was a marriage equality advocate longer than Hillary Clinton. And she has evolved on her views. I love that word, evolved. President Obama uses that word too. It's such a fun word. But they have evolved on their views, I guess, both of them. Just don't tout it that we are endorsing her as the Human Rights Campaign because of her LGBT record, because it's about viability. Call it what it is, and what it is putting your weight behind the candidate you think is most likely to win and thus might do favors for you in the future. So that's what's going on with the Human Rights Campaign. But so much other news all across the country. LGBT rights bills will finally get a hearing in the Indiana legislature next week. The Senate Rules and Legislative Procedures Committee will hold a hearing on two Republican-backed measures, neither of which has generated enthusiasm among LGBT activists. One would ban discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity in such areas as employment, housing, and public accommodations, but it would grant a broad exemption for faith-based discrimination. The other, which would be more accurately called an LGB rights bill, would address sexual orientation only and would also have a fairly broad religious exemption. The issue came to prominence last year with the passage of Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which LGBT advocates and allies said gave businesses and individuals a license to discriminate against LGBT people and others in the name of religion. The widespread criticism, just to remind you, led the legislature and Governor Mike Pence to sign a fix to the law, which was aimed at assuring it would not be used to discriminate and it would not supersede any municipal anti-discrimination laws. So they are still pushing forward, though, in all these different sectors in Indiana with religious exemptions. So we will keep our eye on this next week, because next week they are going to start their debates and start their voting on these bills in Indiana. Non-LGBT Americans, this is a critically important report from GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Non-LGBT Americans are increasingly accepting of LGBT people, but many don't realize what battles remain to be fought for full equality. GLAAD's second annual Accelerating Acceptance Report, based on information gathered for the organization by the Harris Poll last fall, found that respondents' comfort level with LGBT people rose since the previous year. So that's good. That's a really good thing. Other good things among major advances noted in the report released this week are that in 2015, just 29% of respondents said they were somewhat or very uncomfortable with seeing a same-sex couple holding hands, down from 36% in 2014, and only 27% said they would be somewhat or very uncomfortable upon learning a family member was LGBT, down from 32% the year before. Still crazy. We still want to remind everyone, 27% of respondents said they would be somewhat or very uncomfortable upon learning a family member was LGBT. That's important for us all to know. But here's where the problem is. Many participants in the survey were unaware of the challenges still facing LGBT Americans. Half of non-LGBT respondents thought LGBT people had the same rights as anybody else. That's how the survey worded it. When actually 31 states, just to remind everyone, 31 states have no law preventing a person from being fired or denied housing simply for being LGBT. The assumption that LGBT people have equal rights across the board may be due to the widespread publicity about last year's Supreme Court marriage ruling. That's what GLAAD officials said. Here's where it gets even more significant. A significant minority of non-LGBT respondents, 27%, thought violence against transgender people was not a serious problem, even though at least 21 trans women, most of them women of color, were murdered in the U.S. in 2015. And also, 37% of non-LGBT respondents said homelessness among LGBT youth was not a major issue. 37% said homelessness among LGBT youth was not a major issue. And the reality is 40% of homeless young people identify as LGBT. It's not good. It's not good that there is such a disconnect between what is actually happening and the complacency that is clearly there. One more finding, a third of non-LGBT respondents, including some allies, said they had no strong opinion about LGBT issues. Well, the GLAAD president, Sarah Kate Ellis, she said the findings are cause for concern. She said this, quote, "Complacency is the enemy of social progress. 2015 was a monumental year for the LGBT community, but marriage equality is a benchmark, not a finish line. The hard work of legislative change must go hand in hand with that which cannot be decided in a courtroom, changing hearts and minds." So there you go. Complacency is the enemy of social progress. So what does that mean for all of us? That means we actually have to keep talking about all of these issues. We have to keep talking about reparative therapy, conversion therapy, which is only outlawed in, I think last check, it was three states, Washington, D.C., and Cincinnati, Ohio. Those are the only places in the U.S. We have to keep talking about adoption laws, where it is still illegal in so many different states for gay people to adopt legally, for their names to be on those birth certificates. We have to talk about the violence against our trans brothers and sisters, in particular about women of color, trans women of color. We have to talk about youth homelessness. We have to talk about why these things are important and how they affect our lives. Because it's very clear, and this is what we were worried about. I want to see the follow-up poll, by the way, that surveys all the LGBT folks, so many of whom dropped off after marriage equality. Because we put it out there that that was the ultimate victory. That was an actual quote in an article that I read, I think it was last year, and I wrote a Huffington Post piece about it. It was all about marriage equality is the ultimate victory. Well, here's the problem. If you put marriage equality out there as the ultimate victory, when you achieve marriage equality, which we have done, people think, all right, we're victorious. We have won the war. And yet there's still so many battles being fought. And some of them we're going to talk about on this week's show. There's still more. In Iowa legislators, they are now going to investigate. This is what they're going to spend their time on. Iowa legislators are going to investigate a state LGBT youth conference to see if it included inappropriate content, even though the conference receives no state funds. Republican Representative Bobby Kaufman, who is the chair of the Iowa House Government Oversight Committee, he last week appointed two legislators, one Republican and one Democrat, to look into the Iowa Governor's Conference on LGBTQ Youth, which is held annually by Iowa Safe Schools, a nonprofit that focuses on protecting LGBT students from bullying, harassment, and discrimination. The Republican chosen by Kaufman is Representative Greg Hartsill, who is vice chair of the Oversight Committee, who has a history of opposing the conference. This is the guy investigating the conference. He's been on the record as opposing it. Also, Representative Phyllis Thede will be the Democratic investigator. She, quote, has been a strong advocate for safe schools, according to the site. So one for it, one against it. Much of the objection to the conference by anti-gay lawmakers like Kaufman and Hartsill is based on an undercover report from last year's event by an attendee connected with Family Leader, which is an influential anti-gay group in Iowa. The attendee reported that the conference contained graphic discussions of sexual matters. The operative said this, quote, "It's a conference teaching kids how to be confidently homosexual, how to pleasure their gay partners. One session even taught transsexual girls how to sew fake testicles into their underwear." All the reports said, yeah, that's not actually what happened at this conference. When the report initially surfaced, others who had been at the conference, of course, disputed the allegations. They said, nope, not what happened. But again, this is what legislators in Iowa are now going to be spending their time on. They are going to be investigating a state LGBT youth conference. Complacency. Complacency is the enemy of social progress. More news, more news. Some exciting news in Washington. The Equality Act now has bipartisan support in both the U.S. House and Senate, with the announcement by Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois that he has signed on as a co-sponsor. He said this, quote, "Discrimination on the basis of being gay is against the law in Illinois and should be against the law nationwide." Kirk was cheered by the Human Rights Campaign President Chad Griffin. Chad said this, quote, "His support for the Equality Act sends a strong message that fairness and equality are bipartisan values. It also reflects the view of the overwhelming majority of all Americans who believe that everyone, including LGBT people, should be able to have a fair chance to earn a living, provide for their families, and live free from fear of discrimination." The bill, which was endorsed by President Obama last month, would amend the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and other federal laws to protect Americans from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity in employment, housing, public accommodations, and several other areas. Which, of course, is a reminder that currently, sexual orientation, you still can be discriminated on that basis in employment, housing, public accommodations, and several other areas. It's a reminder that gender identity is still the basis for some discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodations, and several other areas. Even though at least one member of the GOP in each chamber supports the bill, most Republicans oppose it, and their control of both the House and Senate means the bill is unlikely to pass this session. But some bipartisan support there. In the great state of Montana, the Treasure State, the governor of Montana has signed an executive order that will protect LGBT state employees from discrimination. On Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Governor Steve Bullock announced at a press conference that it is time to, quote, recommit to King's values of compassion and equity by prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The order expands prohibitions against discrimination to also include pregnancy and military service. The executive order goes into effect immediately and will protect state workers, contractors, and subcontractors from discrimination in employment as well as provision of government services. It also calls, and this is huge, it also calls for diversity programs designed to prevent harassment. So some proactive work there as well. The governor also added this, quote, "While an executive order applies to state government only, I encourage private businesses to examine their policies as well." He also posted this on Twitter. He said, "No hashtag Montanan should be denied full and equal participation in our state's workforce based on discrimination and intolerance." The move was lauded by LGBT activists and groups, including, of course, the Human Rights Campaign. Chad Griffin had another statement here. He praised Bullock's executive order and expressed his hopes that other government leaders will follow his example. Chad Griffin said this, quote, "Discrimination in any form is wrong, and through his actions today, Governor Bullock has taken a bold step to expand equality and fairness for all. We commend him for doing everything in his administrative power to fight for the rights of LGBT Montanans and hope his actions encourage other government officials to make safeguarding protections for all residents and visitors a priority." A lot of progress there in Montana. I love Montana. I have said this earlier in the show years and years ago. I've never been to Montana, but I did my sixth grade report on Montana. I know that it's the Treasure State. It's about all I remember from my sixth grade report, and then I wrote a letter to the governor of Montana at the time. So that was, let's see, 1990, I wrote a letter to the governor of Montana and said, "I'm doing a report on your state. Can you send me stuff?" And they sent me tons of stuff. I believed at the time it was the actual governor who sent it to me. I now know maybe that wasn't true. But at the time, it was very exciting. I was very excited by that. A new organization has arisen. It's a very great one. Gay athletes just got support from a new network with the launch of the Sports Equality Foundation. The organization that boasts the NBA's first openly gay player, Jason Collins, and gay ex-Major League Baseball player, Billy Beane, on their advisory board, they're going to focus on empowering LGBT athletes and coaches to come out. The organization hopes that this will spark change in locker rooms across the country that are so often perceived as unwelcoming to athletes who don't identify as straight. Anthony Nicodemo, a New York high school boys basketball coach, wrote on Wednesday of this week in the Huffington Post this quote: "Since I came out a couple years ago, I found that the most important tool we have to ending homophobia and transphobia in sports is people in sports coming out. More than bringing in campus speakers or conducting sensitivity trainings, it's the people coming out who have truly changed sports culture and shined a light on change that has already occurred." The foundation, which already boasts a $100,000 commitment from the board, will work on several different levels, including providing resources to those who seek to come out and a platform on which those who come out can share their stories. So there you go. Very exciting news. This is the launch of the Sports Equality Foundation, and they will actively be looking to encourage athletes to come out and support them while they do. Very exciting there. Across the seas in Russia, Russia's parliament rejected a bill this week that would have permitted fines or jail time for, quote, homosexual acts. Rights groups have welcomed the move, but they are also calling for a repeal of the 2013 law that they say has encouraged discrimination against non-heterosexuals. It's called a gay propaganda law. Communist Party lawmakers had proposed the measure that was rejected. Had it passed, this is what they were voting on. Had it passed, gay people could have been fined between $50 and $65 for public demonstrations of affection. The proposed measure describes such acts as, quote, expression of non-traditional sexual relations. It could have also led to jail time depending on where the act took place. The Human Rights Watch denounced the bill. The group said the measure would have punished people for expressing their identity. It was a rare win in Russia for lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgender people there. The Human Rights Watch's Russia program director in Moscow, Tanya Lakshina, praised the defeat of the measure in an email, but she said this, quote, however, the parliament has yet to repeal the gay propaganda bill, which has done tremendous damage to Russia's LGBT people. So more work to be done there in Russia. Turning back to the United States, Kim Davis has not gone away. We keep thinking Kim Davis is going to go away, but she keeps finding a way to extend her time in the spotlight. Kim Davis and her lawyers took her fight to the U.S. Court of Appeals in Cincinnati today in the hopes that they could finally convince a judge she was within her rights when she defied a judge's order to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Davis, through her attorneys Matt Staver and the religious right law firm Liberty Counsel, argue in their appeal that she is the victim, a prisoner of conscience, and that her individual freedoms were violated along with her undisputed, sincerely held religious beliefs about marriage. Their case hinges on the idea that the applicants for marriage licenses had no rights based on the law and that denying them licenses placed a burden on their right to marry. Davis's attorneys also argue that former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear could have given her an accommodation but refused. His successor, Governor Matthew Bevin, is named in the suit by the eight plaintiffs who were refused licenses. But without doubt, this is according to The Advocate, without doubt, the most ballsy line in the appeal filed with the court is where Staver and his legal eagles quote the Supreme Court decision that granted marriage equality across the land. They quoted it to support their claim that Judge David Bunning eviscerated Kim Davis's right to due process and flouted principles of federalism. And they quoted right there from Justice Kennedy's decision that was written to support marriage equality. Yeah, I would say yes, that is kind of ballsy. Kind of ballsy of her to do. And finally, for you all, we always have to have some sort of election update. The Ted Cruz effort to paint Donald Trump as a gay rights loving faux conservative from Manhattan is playing a little too loose with the facts in one important place. That's according to The Advocate. During the Republican debate this week, the Texas senator attacked Donald Trump for his New York values, which he defined as socially liberal or pro-abortion or pro-gay marriage, focused around money and the media. But here's the thing, folks, Trump has never supported same-sex marriage. Trump has consistently said he supports marriage between a man and a woman whenever he was asked this over the years, including all the way back in the year 2000 when he was asked this by The Advocate. Even in the Meet the Press interview from 1999 that Cruz is using to make his attack about New York values, Trump never endorses marriage equality, instead saying it's too premature for me to comment on. That has not stopped Ted Cruz's rhetoric from echoing through several media outlets, including The Washington Post, which mentions Trump's previous support on social issues such as same-sex marriage. So yeah, it's just not true. It's not true that Donald Trump has ever supported same-sex marriage. The Human Rights Campaign notes that Trump may have had a mixed message about LGBT rights, but he's never outright endorsed same-sex marriage. He has historically supported benefits for domestic partnerships, and he's withdrawn support for civil unions. So he has been all over the place. Trump did say that he was evolving. Again, that word evolving. Trump did say that he was evolving on LGBT rights and marriage equality in 2013 after the Miss Universe pageant caused a media firestorm when it chose Russia as its host country. At the time, the country had just passed, as we just said, their ban on so-called gay propaganda, which led Donald Trump to conclude that the United States is ahead of Russia when it comes to this stuff. But apparently, the evolution has stopped there. So if people are telling you that Donald Trump, well, at least he's pro-gay marriage, he is absolutely not pro-gay marriage. He has never said that. You know, the fun thing about doing this radio show and the fun thing about media is that things can happen even when I'm recording right now. So everything that I just told you earlier about the Human Rights Campaign's endorsement of Hillary Clinton, a piece that I just wrote for the Huffington Post, just got published. So you can stroll on over to the Huffington Post and you can click on HRC's endorsement of Hillary Clinton was disingenuous and unnecessary. And that is a piece that I have penned for the Huffington Post about, yeah, HRC's endorsement of Hillary Clinton, it was disingenuous. And I think it was totally unnecessary. There's no reason for them to do that at this point. There are two candidates. Let us vote. Let the primaries happen. Let us vote and then step forward and do something. Okay? Then you can endorse the candidate and say, yes, we need to support this person because a Republican, that cannot happen. They would turn the tides. But right now, HRC's endorsement of Hillary Clinton, disingenuous. Totally unnecessary. You can check that out over on the Huffington Post. Our huge, huge thanks to Heather Kronk. What an absolute treat having her on this week's episode. You all need to get out there and check out getequal.org. They are doing some incredible work over there, some grassroots work. So while our national organizations are operating on that lobbying front, Get Equal is really trying to change the tide by building some grassroots movements. So strolling over to getequal.org. We have a really fun show for you next week. We're going to talk to another change maker who's doing some incredible things. So you're going to have to come back for that. But in the meantime, you know what to do. You got to get out there. You got to use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. Whatever it is that you do best, whether you are hosting a radio show or you are a cupcake wizard and make all these pro-gay cupcakes and give them out to people. That's our shout out to Becca. We've got to get her back on the show. I can almost see her right now wanting to be back on the show. Do whatever it is that you do to make a difference in this world. Get out there and do it. And while you're doing it, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay.
This is how it's always been. Sun comes up, the day begins. People come and then they go. I've been around long enough to know. If you have a single seed, that's enough, that's all you need. And if you're lost in the